Okay, we're on now.
I get some.
All right, welcome to the September meeting of the Harbor Advisory Board. We'll go through the roll call first and let the record show that all are present except Lynn Meissen. And then we'll next move on to approval of the minutes. And, okay, the next item is the presentation of the action items. And the first one is the presentation on the Morro Bay Summer Beach Lifeguard Program. And Rick, would you be so kind as to introduce the two young gentlemen?
Yes, thank you. Good evening, board members. The Harbor Department does manage a summer beach lifeguard program. It entails us hiring approximately 10 individuals every year as temporary laborers during the summer, or temporary employees during the summer. And this year we had somewhat unique situation where we found we had two exceptional young people who'd been working for us for a number of years that we put in charge as beach lifeguard supervisors. And I asked them to come make a presentation to the board tonight. So I'd like to introduce Dimitri Jaroki and Cale Moore.
Very good. Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you. We just finished a really busy summer, busier than average. I think we had over 350 beach patrons at a single time this summer on several occasions, which I know at least sets a record from last year. And we had a really good safety record. I think we had 220 preventative actions. That's a little bit of a rough estimate, but at least 21 medical aids, 11 surf rescues, and 4 missing persons. So it's a pretty busy summer, and the majority of that action was actually in the end of June and the beginning of July, and it kind of slowed down after that. The crowds remained pretty high, but we actually had, I think, only one or two of those rescues in August. The rest were all in July and end of June. We also started the recycling program on the beach. Instead of just throwing out all the trash, we got recycling bins for plastic and bottles and cans. And the lifeguards in their downtime picked up, we approximated about 100 pounds of garbage off the beach. So we're pretty proud of that. The other thing that we got involved with this year was the United States Life Saving Association's Nationals competition in Huntington Beach, and we sent a team down with the county chapter for the USLA, and we competed.
I think you guys do a great job. Just a point, I was out swimming by the rock the other day, and I noticed that as the tide fills in, the current that runs along the jetties there, the riprap, seems to get a lot stronger.
Yeah.
So you guys might just keep that in mind. So.
Yeah, thanks. That at the beginning of the season is usually much stronger, and towards the end of the season we had a lot less rescues in that particular place. So, yeah, that's one of our main focus areas for rescues.
I would just like to know how many lifeguards you have out there.
On weekdays, we have 3 lifeguards that get to the beach at 10 o'clock, and we have them all at Tower 1, and then we open Tower 2 at 12 o'clock, and that runs till 5 o'clock. So 3 lifeguards on weekdays and 4 lifeguards on weekends.
And a total staff of about 9 lifeguards this summer. 9, I think.
Very good, and thank you for your efforts, too.
Okay. You had 4 missing, I caught the part about the rescues. You had 4 missing persons incidents. Those were not fatalities, though, this summer, were they?
No. Yeah, sorry, those were not, yeah, there was no fatalities of this summer. They were missing children just on the beach on usually I think they were busy weekend days is when it seems to happen the most. And we, with the help of the Harbor Patrol and I think the police department, we've located all 4 of them.
Mostly just kids wandering off down the beach with shells and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you.
It does keep the parents a little bit paranoid, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Ed?
Now, I'm just curious how you fix for equipment. You got all the stuff you need?
Yeah.
Like binoculars, like real powerful binoculars and all of the things you might need while you're sitting there looking?
Yeah, we are. We're pretty good on equipment. This year, we actually purchased two new rescue paddle boards, which is a change from the ones we had in the past, which were pretty beat up, and they weren't specifically rescue boards. They were just surfboards. We modified them. These ones they have handles that are professionally put on there and in the right place, and they're labeled rescue, and so they're definitely an upgrade. We got two of them this summer, and maybe in the future we're going to have to replace the rest of them. But
there are more people using the cloisters access, so we're it's stretching our ability to supervise the area from Tower 2. So I've been hearing for a couple of years from our lifeguards that they would like to see a third tower down at just north of 41. There's a lot of questions that go with that on staffing, costs, and everything else. But at least this year I've gone far enough where I've asked these folks to, at least these two, to give me an analysis on what it would cost to build them, and then we'll start looking at staffing, and that may be something that we could look at next year. A couple other things. These two individuals represent, I think, how we like to see everything work. They've done a great job for us. They also, Dimitri came here, I think, from the Bay Area to go to Cal Poly. Cale was raised in this area, but they both have indicated an interest in to us, I think, over the last year, where they've worked part-time as available, assisting the Harbor Patrol in some of their duties and learned some of the other skills that the Harbor Patrol officers have, and now they're in a position, I think, where we'll probably be picking up these two as Harbor Patrol reserves. So you may be seeing them around a little longer, even beyond their beach lifeguard time. And that's a great way, I think, for the city to help them learn new skills and also for us to build skilled people that are available to work for us. one final note, and I think Paul's going to help me here. We brought in some new signs today, and I hope that Paul might be able to switch the camera over to the wall there. And we have, as I think some of you may remember, based on, in part, some discussion that started at the Harbor Advisory Board about putting better beach warning signs up and beach informational signs. Mm-hmm. The Chief Harbor Patrol Officer worked with Goofy Graphics designing these new signs up. One is informational, you might say, which, unfortunately, informational these days is pretty much what you can't do, but that's life. So you can see the sign on the left there is beach information. That one is labeled Morro Rock Access. I think there's three that will be put up in the Morro Rock Access, and I think there's three other access points, and they're labeled correctly for their different access point. But the information is the same, basically. And we will be installing those signs over the next month. And then, of course, the warning sign there, and that's probably a little harder to read if Paul can go back there. The beach warning sign is advising on various hazards. And my, I think that's the, it's probably a little hard to pick out, but the decal on the bottom, or it's actually a stuck-on thing on rift currents. And that's good information, and we left space there. We can put up our tsunami information, one which is under development still. And those signs will also be put up in the same locations.
Very good.
I would particularly like the Do Not Pet the Sharks.
Yes. That's, I like that one, too.
Yeah, they're... Well, thank you very much, guys.
All right, thank you.
Okay, moving on. The next item on the agenda is North Embarcadero Waterfront, new Futures Committee presentation. And Rick, would you be so kind as to introduce these gentlemen?
Well, sure. We have two individuals from the new Futures Committee here, John and Bill Newman. And gosh, maybe I'll just pass it over to you.
That's great. Thank you very much for allowing us to be here. We're representing the new Futures Committee. We were pulled together by the City Council earlier this year, and we were given the responsibility to make recommendation to the City Council regarding what might happen to the property where the power plant currently resides, all or some portion of that property in the future. The first thing we always hear when we start talking about this is that if LS Power, the current owner of the plant, builds a new plant, then our committee just kind of goes a ways and does nothing. The truth of the matter is that if LS Power, whatever LS Power does, and they're the owner of the property and they're going to make their decision on what to do, whatever they do, there's going to be an opportunity for us here in the city to do something with a portion of that property at least. The way we're looking at it, this is there's three potential options that might happen. The first one is nothing happens. The plant continues to operate as it currently operates. In that case, the plant stays, but the opportunity would be the tank farm area, which there's four large oil tanks on the back side of the property that occupy a large piece of property that would be surplus property to LS Power. At that point, there was something that could be done with that. We would look at this scenario as probably the least likely scenario. The second possibility, which is the most likely scenario, and we say it's most likely because this is the plan that LS Power is currently trying to implement, and that is to do something in that on that site based on the way that the plan works out with LS Power. I want to say right up front that our committee is power plant neutral. We do not have an opinion whether there should be a power plant or should not be a power plant. Our role is to, under each of those options, come up with the recommendations to the city council on what could be put onto those pieces of property. Our role here tonight is really to talk to you as a board, because I think you probably, and we already know from Rick, that you probably have some strong ideas about what might go on that piece of property. It's also to talk to you as individuals, because we, not only as a board, but we'd like to hear from you and everybody else here as individuals what your ideas might be in terms of how we could use that property going forward. We've got kind of a multiple phase attack at this project. We're in phase one right now, which is really the data gathering phase. So we're reaching out to everybody we can reach out to, all the city commissions, the boards, business groups, and so forth, to get information. We have a website that's up and running right now. We'll pass out at the end of our presentation an announcement regarding a workshop that'll be coming up, and the website address is on there. Kind of encourage you to take a look at the website. It discusses the three scenarios. It discusses a whole lot more about what's going on. There's also associated with that a Yahoo discussion group. So if you have questions or comments, you can join the group. You can post your questions, post your answers as best we can, and as quickly as we can, we'll get the answers to those questions put up on the website. And everybody who joins the discussion group in the entire community will have an opportunity to benefit from everything that's been put on the site. Let me turn this over to Bill for a minute right now. He'll talk about an event we have coming up in the next few weeks.
Good evening. My part is to tell you about the workshop that's coming up on September 30th at the Community Center from 11 to 3. When we say 11 to 3, that doesn't mean you have to stay 4 hours. We have a format whereby you could stay 15 minutes or 4 hours, whatever your heart desires, to the extent of your participation. The way it's going to work is when you get there at the community center, off to the left is that little meeting room, and we'll get and help you out if you need any help. And when you leave, they'll probably be asking you what you thought of the thing. Then you go on into the main big room, and we'll have 5 stations. Each station will have a topic like visitors or recreation or whatever. And you can go to any one of those stations. We have one that's called Other, so if you're left out, you can go there too. But you go to the station, any station you want, and there'll be a few chairs around, and you can sit down and talk to the committee member who's there, and also talk to the people that are sitting there too, and brainstorm and ask questions. And we'll have the committee member writing down all the ideas that come up, and we'll have a few up there to piggyback on for ideas. We'll have plenty of information at the table. If you didn't want to talk, you could write it down, and we'll try to have every possible way for anybody to participate, get all the ideas we can. Then our next phase, after we collect all the information that we can about ideas for it, will be to evaluate those ideas, and that's another phase where we'll probably have another community event to get people involved in evaluating what would be good. So that's the general process we're following, and I hope you can come to the meeting and give us your ideas and interact with the people who are there. I think it'll be very interesting, educational, and profitable to everybody. Come and go to one spot and spend a few minutes, or come and go to every spot and give ideas. It's a very open system. I think you'll like it. Come on out.
Okay. Eddie, I'm going to let you go first.
Questions? Yeah, well, I just want you to keep something in mind when people are suggesting for development there. Adjacent to the new site, if they build a new power plant, fine, but adjacent to that, if they don't build a new site, there's ideas of putting a boatyard there. And if you put a boatyard there, you're going to have a little bit of noise, and you're going to have a little bit of dust. Mm-hmm. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, and so anything that you put in that new plant site, you'd want to have enough setback from that boatyard, if it is put in, to not cause problems and conflicts between the uses of both properties.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing we'll be wanting to do when we evaluate the mm-hmm. ideas that we have. We've got to think of things like that, and our committee is doing a lot.
If the construction project should take place, did the final settlement agreement include dedicating the old plant site to the city? I was kind of out of the loop.
No, it doesn't have any. There's nothing that says they have to. If anything happens like that, LS Energy will still own the property, and somebody will have to buy it from them. I don't think they're going to give it away. So it's matter of us coming up with things, and probably more people than our committee, maybe other committees, but eventually come up with something that maybe a developer would be willing to invest in. That's a consideration. We have a finance committee, subcommittee, too. Mm-hmm. You got to have some way to finance whatever's in there, whatever goes in there. So it might be a developer, or there might be huge grants if there's some, maybe another Monterey Aquarium, if somebody wants to do it. You have to get money.
Too bad things dragged out so long, because that was originally going to happen. But
there is an exhibit attached to the outfall lease, which is your letter, that is part of the actual lease agreement, that does say that LS Power would cooperate with the city of Morro Bay with whatever happens to the future of the power plant site. So they recognize they've got an obligation to do that, and I think they're demonstrating that obligation by working with us fairly closely.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I did take a look at your website briefly, and I was, being fairly new to the community, I was impressed by the aerial view of that area, which I hadn't seen by driving by it before. How many acres are we talking about encompassing all of the property that is under your futures committee
There's jurisdiction? Approximately 107 acres.
107?
It's very difficult. Some of that property is already under easement to the city of Morro Bay, for example, where the ballparks are off of Main Street there. Some of it's being used, I guess, for some boatyard storage things right now. Some of it is protected environment as well. So that's one of the things we're trying to do in what Bill was talking about, to present to the public at the meeting on September 30th is, I really can't answer that question. We really haven't gotten the dimensions down yet. Rob Schultz is working on that for us, but hopefully by September 30th we'll be able to answer that question clearly.
One more, if you will, please. If the LS Power does build a new plant, and they do own the old plant, who would be responsible for, I think your website said $40 million in cost to destroy it or to tear it down?
That answer gets complicated. The remediation for the property, to a large extent, belongs to PG&E. The remove, and that's partial remediation. It's not complete. The movement, I've got to be careful how I say this, because there's a lot of people that would like to see the power plant remain as a building and be converted to a museum or something like that. So I've got to be careful about saying taking down the power plant. The $40 million was to remove the power plant, and that would be the responsibility of whoever buys the property.
The new owner.
So that would be, I think, reflected in the price of the purchase price of the property.
Okay. Thank you.
A couple, 3 points here. Do we have any time frame when LS Power is going to make some kind of decision?
You've got all the tough questions. No, and we actually asked that question last week, and the answer was they really don't know. There's you know, a lot of approvals that they've got to go through. The time frame is who knows. There's a law case, a legal case in New York right now that I guess is going to the Supreme Court, but apparently isn't on the docket yet, but would potentially impact the decision that LS Power may have going forward. You know, it's 3 to 5 years, something like that would be.
Okay.
But if
I'm just curious. And you, as you may or may not know, I've been an advocate for a marine research facility for 20-some years here. I think it's a great opportunity for that location. There are very few places in Morro Bay where there's both an intake and a discharge already established. And I've known Bill from Friends of the Estuary for a number of years. My third point is, I think
before you leave that point, I just wanted to butt in and say, I am taking a station called Research and Technology and Science. So come to my booth.
Okay. And I noticed you've got some great people on your steering committee.
And get some demolition work there.
Yeah, I think you're correct. I don't know what the time frames were on that.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that if they build a new plant, they're going to have to tear the old stacks down and do the demolition work on the old.
Yeah,
to the extent that they want, anyway.
One of the committee members is doing a summary on the outfall lease, and we hope to have the key points of that lease available at the meeting on the 30th, so these questions will be answered, but that's a good point.
Okay.
Did they have something else?
When I was involved with that, the project, if it were built, was one construction project that involved demolition and cleanup of the old plant site. It was all part of one construction project that included starting the new plant, and as soon as they switched the transmission lines and the gas lines over to the new plant, that triggered the start of the demolition of the old plant and the cleanup of the old site. And that may have changed, but I thought that's what Duke was selling when they sold the project, the completed project that's been approved except for Regional Water Quality Control Board. It was approved by the California Energy Commission with those intact, I believe. So,
explain the, I'm pretty sure. The pollution cleanup system and how much it would be.
Yeah, I think you're correct, and I don't believe anything has changed. We'd obviously have to go back to Rob and verify that. It just, I didn't mean to make confusion here. What I was saying is that some people say, geez, we'd really like to keep the plant. You know, if the plant closes, we might want to convert that plant into another use. And I just, we're trying to put everything on the table. Everybody's idea goes on the table now. We're trying not to eliminate anything. So that would require some changes in the agreements, but we're just trying to keep the door open for every possible idea.
Okay. I don't know if it's clear, but when PG&E sold it, they are still responsible for cleanup of any pollution to the extent that the new power plant could be built there, but not beyond that. So if somebody wanted to build a hotel, for example, there might still be more cleanup.
And I might make a comment. I was reluctant because it's been long enough. I can't remember the specific details. It's been a while since I reviewed it, but I thought there was a 3-year time frame that started running in the option should the modernized plant be built at the point that it gets the go-ahead, and as you say, the gas lines get hooked up and it begins operation. I thought it was a 3-year time frame for
problems. And Rick, I guess I'm going to let you start on that.
All right, thank you. Just as an overview, we've actually organized this as two agenda items. They're really kind of the same subject, but I wanted to break them apart. Mm-hmm. The first item was to discuss our follow-up on our discussion with your last meeting on pollution threats. And I gave you at your last meeting, I gave you a lot of background on how some of those specific issues that came about. And then we talked about how we might work to take steps to prevent those types of things, or at least reduce them in the future. Almost anything we might suggest would require an amendment or and a City Council approval of changes to our rules and regulations, which are set by City Council resolution. So I was hoping to have that discussion on steps we might recommend to the Council on the remediating threats to pollute in the harbor first. And then the second item here is the harbor rules and regulations, and maybe we could, after hopefully get some focus out of the first part, if and we can move on to the rules and regs. There are some other changes when we get to that item, the rules and regs, that we're suggesting and updating, because it's been 6 or 7 years with those. So on the item to options that may prevent or reduce future pollution and derelict vessel problems, I have repeated some of the four suggestions that we had in your staff report here from the last meeting. I would like to give you a little perspective to this off the agenda item here. We feel like we have done a lot to prevent pollution, and we continue to do a lot to improve the pollution issues in the harbor. It is a difficult situation. You know, there in some people's minds today, there is an expectation of maybe zero tolerance for any pollution, any petroleum products in the water. That's a high level to set when you're a developed harbor and you have equipment, machineries, human uses all around and on the water. I don't know that that would ever be feasible, but yet that is the expectation in some people's minds in today's world. We have over the years done a lot to reduce pollution threats to the harbor, and some of those things, for example, are the installation of the oily bilge water pump out on the South T Pier, the setup of our oil recycling center, used oil recycling centers. So hopefully that focuses more of that type of activity. We have pursued an aggressive derelict vessel demolition program for many years, and we've talked about that before. Most years we're breaking up two or three or four vessels, and we just try to do it however we can and as quietly as we can. And for the most part, that seemed to keep ahead of the problem. Unfortunately, this last year we got caught, and I think to some major extent it reflects the decline in fishing and the fact, as we discussed it at the last meeting, that we are see this year and in the future that there will be more abandoned vessels with maybe more substantial pollution issues than we've had in the past. And so this year, with the number of highly visible, and of course this year throwing in the Back Bay vessels, which we were sort of blessed with having those vessels come our way, and we still have a number of those vessels all over the place. That, you know, the good news is we cleaned up the Back Bay. The bad news is that about a third of them are still around. We, you know, had these highly publicized spills and sinkings, and it was frustrating to us, frankly. You know, it's a, we feel like we do a lot, and we have done a lot, and yet then immediately we're getting calls from people going, "What are you guys doing? You're just sitting down there doing nothing, you know, while these boats are sinking." And, geez, don't you think about this? And so we've tried to spread the word a little bit, and that was helpful at that last meeting to tell people all the things we're doing, and I appreciate the chance tonight to talk about this a little bit. But clearly, the public wants us to try to do more. That's pretty clear to me. These are evolving areas, and the public would like more protection and has a higher, you know, 15 years ago, I was told when I came here that, our harbor perspective was that if you paid your fees on your moorings, that was what we cared about. If your boat wasn't pretty or didn't run, that was kind of your business. And, you know, that was our approach to the harbor here. Now, it may be that that's basically the things I'm suggesting to you, recommending to you, it would change that a little bit, that attitude. It would put us in a position of providing another level of service is a good way to look at it. We would now have to make decisions, more actively review boats, make decisions on if a vessel seemed to be necessary in all these four areas. But it might be time to turn this over to you, too. We have worked with a multi-agency effort first listed. I want to thank Osprey for coming up here. The silver lining to all these incidents that we had is that the State Fish and Game Oil Spill Prevention Response Office has stepped in and become very helpful. And they are now working with us, and we are identifying vessels, and they have the authority and the resources to require a vessel to pump off fuel if it's concerned to them. And I think they are looking at a couple of other vessels now in the harbor on those grounds. And they did do that with the C, which was a back bay vessel, which has now come into one of our slips while it is hopefully being resolved by Fish and Game Department enforcement section. So that part is going ahead. We're doing that, and that's something we would just have done anyway. Working with Osprey is a little bit more work, but we're glad to have their help. Many of these other options have significant cost, either in staff time to the boaters or probably both in most cases. So what I'm recommending to you to consider would be this option of changing our rules and regulations to require an operability or seaworthiness test for vessels of concern. And maybe I'll open it to questions with that.
Okay. Before I bring it into the board, I'll open it for public comment. Is there anybody wishing to make any statement? Please come forward, give your name.
How you doing? I'm John Tommy Rosas. I'm owner-operator of Magnum Yacht Construction, also a merchant mariner with the Coast Guard. I had a couple ideas. I read the this goes along with this gentleman. I think it might be good to have and I'm volunteering or offering my services at a boat builder. I've built documented vessels under the Coast Guard certification, Lloyd's and all that. And if you had someone, not saying that they don't know what they're doing, but if you had someone as a boat builder that could keep these boats evaluated and know, you know, the gray area before it's too late and cause the damages, would be I'd offer to do that. I'm also in discussions with the Bayfront Marina on opening a boat repair shop, because I'm not really from this area, but I'm considering staying and doing boat work. So if there's a gray area, I think that if you have someone.
The board, and I'll start with you, Roger.
I think that whether it's our homes, our businesses, or our automobiles, we have a level of responsibility to the community as a whole to maintain them to a safe and clean level. If the fire department sees hazardous materials or fire safety hazards, they can come onto our private property and eliminate that hazard if we choose not to do it for them when requested. Same thing with our automobiles. We have to, every 2 years, go in and get them certified. I think that it's time for something to happen, and boat owners who are responsible don't want irresponsible boat owners causing problems that could lead to fires, for instance, next door to them. And just like in past years, the mooring inspections. You don't want somebody dragging a mooring and crashing into your boat after you've complied with the law. There's a responsibility of the ownership, and I think it's on the boat owners to demonstrate, whether it's having a marine survey if that's necessary, or hiring a staff person or somebody else, some way of certifying, yes, this boat can stay safely afloat and contain its chemicals for another 2 years or whatever the inspection period might be. I don't think it's the city's responsibility to do that. I think it's the owner of the property, the boat owner's responsibility to do that, because if it puts Rick and his staff in a really awkward position, in my opinion, to have to go around and be boat police without. I just don't think that's a very effective way of doing it. I think that there needs to be a demonstration by the owner of the property, the boat in this case, just like with a building or a business. Fire department can come and do an inspection and certify us, or we get our smog check. And I think it's time for that, because we don't want any more boats sinking. I don't think we want to put undue stress or hardship on boat owners, but just a reasonable demonstration that the boat is seaworthy enough to stay afloat. It doesn't have to be capable of going to Catalina and back, but not causing pollution in the bay. That's where I'd like to see us go.
Of the rainwater that had outboard motor oil in the bottom of their skiff, and they were considering figuring out some ways to find everybody. Well, lo and behold, they received the Boston Whaler, and they put it in the slip right there. Well, what happened when it rained? They had no way to get rid of the water. They didn't know what to do. So their solution was to take the boat out of the water. But that doesn't keep a working waterfront going. So, you know, there will be occasionally some small spills, and those things just happen. We live in a built environment. And then getting back to the auctions here, I kind of think all this stuff will eventually just go away. I mean, I know the Harbor Department has been diligently removing derelict boats and being on top of it for 20 years. I mean, I've watched them. And there will be some commercial boats that are going to have some problems, but I think most of these we're going to try to stay on top of. Last month, Jim made a proposal or talked about maybe a clause in a city facilities that would require a document be signed by the boat owner that would allow Harbor Department to take immediate action if it deemed necessary. And I didn't see that in the rules and regulation proposal, and I don't know where that goes, but that's where I'd like to see something like that.
Okay. Ed?
Well, I'm not opposed to having ordinance for an inspection of vessels that may or may not be ready to sink, but the way I look at it here, no matter what you do in the bay, this is a harbor of safe refuge with 120 so miles between harbors from the north and another 120 south, so you're going to have boats come by here that are not in good shape. I'm going to have problems. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. You're going to have fishing boats that are fishing out in front here and come in. And you can have all the inspectors you want. The guy comes in, he's got a wooden boat and the garber plank's leaking. What are you going to do? You can stop part of that from the inside, but really you need to haul the boat out. And there's no haul-out facilities here. And I just think it's time to get at least a basic haul-out with, say, a 100-ton travel lift and a boat yard that can haul out boats and stack about 20 of them in a yard with the facilities that they can work on their own boats or hire somebody to come in and fix the boats. Without that boat yard, you get a boat that's over 45 feet here, you're in trouble. You're going to have to deal with it just like you dealt with those other boats. You're going to have
$1 million for concept plan development on the boat yard based on the boating access facilities recommendation of 10 years ago. Sort of a very broad sort of outline of some boatyard and dry storage development north of the intake structure. We did put some money aside for concept plan work this year. I have not started that project yet.
I was thinking that maybe when there's time available, I know that this plan that they used to have that I'm looking at here is probably way too large for what we need for a facility to at least to stop this problem, or at least ameliorate part of the problem anyway. And I would like to at least see a basic haul out with 100-ton travel lift and a place to put 20, 30 boats. I think that the yard would never pay for itself, but it would probably pay for its own operation. And maybe we can get together, and when you have time or somebody else has time, to get together with Bill Boucher and check where the Embarcadero is going to go and where the outfall is and how much they think they'd have to beef up the concrete to go over that outfall line that goes underneath that property. And start getting this started, and then see if we can eventually, if we get the conceptual drawing done, it's smaller than this one is, because this, I think there'd be problems trying to do all that's, that was discussed before. But get a basic boatyard put in where some work can be done, and see if we can't get some grants to be able to build the thing. You know, I know I've been mentioning around that 100-ton travel is going to be $900,000, $1 million probably. I know Driscoll bought one for $900,000, and he put an additional $1.5 million in the yard here without, I would say, $3.5 to $4 million probably to put a boatyard in here. It's a lot of money, and it's going to have to be grants. But I would like to see some concept drawn and approved by the council if it's done right, and go from there so we can at least start getting a total price and looking for grants. And I think that's the long term. We need a boatyard here, without a doubt. So that's basically what I have to say about it.
Jim.
I certainly agree with the concept of a boatyard, both from the standpoint of having a boat and needing the services of one, plus the a place to put boats that need to be hauled out. What I want to speak to towards, at least, is the idea of seeing what that rental agreement is. But I would think that as a condition, even though this is a safe harbor, that if you're going to anchor in an area that's governed by the city or go to a mooring or a slip or whatever, that even if you rent it just for the night, that you would fall into the category of having a rental agreement. And part of the conditions of that rental agreement certainly could be that the Harbor Department has a right to inspect the boat for its seaworthiness and stability. I've made reference before, and it's referred to here, that the State Park Marina has a contract, and it's enforced through its operator, Associated Pacific. And I just want to read one part of it. It's got 38 rules, but rule number 35 says any pumping or other service needed on boats, which if not performed may endanger the marina or other boats, may be accomplished by the marina at the cost of materials plus any labor and equipment charges per APC rate sheet. So, and that doesn't matter, I don't suppose, whether it's a documented boat or not. If it's in the State Park Marina and you're ready to slip, then the rules of the agreement follow suit. And rather than just having once a year determination of seaworthiness, I would think a more tight kind of regulation having the force of the renal agreement would be more serviceable in that regard. That's my comment.
Okay, I guess it's my turn. As I see it, I hear essentially there's two cases here. One is the problems that we're having with the commercial boats and the situation with the commercial fishing going down the tubes pretty badly. The other one is there are an awful lot of recreational boats sitting out there in the bay that I look at as I go down there all the time, and I look at some of them, and it's amazing that they're still afloat. And I recall reading in one of the publications that come through the Yacht Club occasionally, and they were talking about Newport Harbor and what they have. And they have a situation where their harbor patrol goes through, and if they see a boat that really looks like it's in really crummy shape, they make the assumption that this could be a problem, and they designate it as a possible derelict boat. What they have said is Newport Harbor had a mess, pretty much like we have. They don't have a mess anymore. Now, I grant you that this is an awful lot of work, an awful lot more of a job for the Harbor Department, but it's something that maybe we need to look at rather than have these boats sinking on us. If we take a proactive stance rather than a reactive, you know, reactive is where you dive on the boat and put flotation tanks in it. So, anyhow, I do support the idea of whether we could do something that they have done down in Newport Harbor or not, I don't know. But I do support the some sort of a test to make sure that a boat is seaworthy. And I don't think it should be just for the commercial boats. I think it really needs to go to all of them. Okay? Gene, I think you have a...
I just, you know, you just kill me when you think about making this a Newport Beach. I have a question, Rick. What happens if a boat comes in and you guys deem it's unsafe? Do you just send it back out again?
No, you can't.
Well, then, where are you at?
Well, okay, so I'd like, yeah, is this an opportunity? Maybe I'll catch up on a few other things that kind of came up, too. But to answer that question, so a transient vessel or any vessel at our facilities has to sign a berthing agreement. In the case of transient vessels, it's quite a simple agreement. It's a card. Many of you have probably seen them. Anybody comes in at a city facility, and one of the things, they sign it on the back, and they sign away. They agree to pay all fees, and they agree to abide by all our adopted rules and regulations. So they do sign those, a transient person. Now, a person on a city mooring or in a city slip has a somewhat more lengthy monthly agreement, and they have double. They sign away all their rights in a few different varieties of ways. But basically, we already get that agreement for folks at city facilities, either daily or monthly, that they will abide by our rules and regulations. So I think that part might be done. So that's one reason I've tried to focus on, well, we could change our rules and regulations to give us an operational ability to do maybe more of what we want to do. You've asked a great question that bedevils us all the time. What do you actually do in the case of, you know, and I go back to Mr. Anderson's comments about the boat owner rules and regulations to, say, require operability or seaworthiness test, and they did not provide that or cooperate, we could cite and or put on our impound mooring, much like just what you described, which, you know, Newport Beach or Santa Barbara. I don't care what you want to, you know, the Santa Barbara mooring area. But this is not untypical. And I think we do have the rights to, you know, certainly, the law certainly provides us, I think, background to do these things, and it's fairly well settled, to be more aggressive and to talk a little bit to Jim's suggestion that we potentially become more aggressive in this and say, well, we're going to take action to pump off and actually, you know, seize and or destroy the vessel. That becomes, in my mind, much more problematic because of potential conflicts with state and federal law, and also because of tremendous potential costs, you know, in the pump out, taking on the, basically assuming stewardship of the vessel during that time, the value of the vessel, a lot of other legal costs. So one of the reasons I see the operability and seaworthiness clause as a lesser step than such as, you know, telling people that, okay, we're going to give ourselves, we could change our rules and regulations and say, okay, we have the right to come get your boat if you don't do what we want. But that might lead the public to think that we could do things that we really can't do, either because of human staff resources or because of, you know, basic law and legal and tremendous costs involved in every single case. So I don't recommend that, but I'd like to hear your comments. I mean, we can look into that further, but I would probably end up telling you that, you know, we will need to take some real time to look at this legally and to see if we can staff it. So I tried to cover a lot of ground. I hope I answered your question, too.
Jim?
In Eric Endersby's harbor report in the Sun Bulletin yesterday, he talks about a vessel, BNA, I think it was, that was listing, and they went aboard and found that there was water, and they put an automatic pump in it. The source of the leak was undisclosed, according to his report, and then that was the end of the report, except to say that the owner wasn't here, apparently, and wasn't able to get to the boat right away. So using that as an example, what can you do to prevent that boat from sinking?
Gosh, and that one doesn't come to mind on that specific example, but that, for example, you know, is that a general case? Well, obviously, we do the first thing, sort of an emergency step. So what we can do is somewhat limited, you know, but if it's at city facilities in the longer term, beyond just putting pumps on and dealing with the emergency and get a hold of the owner, which is our first steps and, you know, the responsible party.
Okay.
I could tell a little bit about that boat.
I don't know if that was a sign I was mumbling or she...
Well, no, just that in that particular case, we were able to get a hold of the owner, and they did come down. What happens sometimes is the owners don't live here. They live hours away. So by the time we call them, then they have to arrange their schedule so they can get down here or up here, whatever the case may be, to take care of their issues. And these people did come, and they are dealing with the issue. I don't know if they'll deal with it to the extent we might like, but they are trying to be responsible in dealing with the issue. I don't know if they have yet figured out exactly why it was leaking, but they did come up and start dealing with the issue. So we do, of course, try to contact the owners as soon as we realize something is a problem. There often is difficulty getting them here as quickly as we might like because they're not close by.
That's exactly the point where my concern is, because from the time that the owner is notified and to the time they can respond to the problem, that leak can develop into a bigger leak and the boat can go to the bottom. And therein lies the problem. If the Harbor Department can't take more aggressive action do something right away, if they have to wait for the owner to accumulate the funds or travel here or fly in from Texas or wherever they come from, then that just makes the whole situation vulnerable to unwanted consequences.
If that was your question, we do, that's a pretty routine thing for us when call-outs in the night or during the day, when we get a report. A lot of times it happens first thing in the morning. We get a report of, at dawn, we observed this vessel low in the water, sinking, half sunk, whatever. And we take immediate action to put pumps on as we can and immediately notify the owner and make an assessment of how soon they're going to get here and be able to take steps to help themselves. So that's what we do. And that's another thing, really, in a lot of ways, that's not only protection of property, but that's to reduce the threat of pollution. That's, again, a big step and a service we provide, I think, for the Bay. I thought I was kind of focusing on in the longer run, I think, one of the tools that might be improved would be to say, hey, we've got a clear standard here in the harbor, too.
The boat that sank at the pier, what tools can we suggest to the council they enact that would allow you to have taken action? That boat was obviously being ignored, not being well maintained. What tools can we give you or suggest that would enable you to act sooner and have prevented that boat from sinking so that and obviously, unless we charge a fee of the boat owners, that's going to enable you to bring on more staff. You don't have the resources financially to take it on. So is there some rule, some legal way to give you the teeth to take care of that sooner so we don't have the same results? I guess that's really the big concern, is the boat sinking.
Yeah, and that's a great question. And I think the answer is going to be that we can't, I don't know that there's any way that we can prevent every single sinking incident. That one, there might have been things that we could have done different in retrospect, to be honest with you. What happened in that, to review that case, was that we became aware when the night watchman left, who apparently had been manning the pumps, we didn't even know he left, but we found out because all of a sudden we got reports that the vessel was taking on water and pumps weren't working. And we then became aware of the condition of the vessel. We were sort of concerned about it, but had never really boarded the vessel, and because the pumps had been maintained and to some extent, And that was only a relatively short period. I'm thinking roughly a month and a half or 2 months before it actually sank. Mm-hmm. We spent that period trying to get a hold of the owner to get him to take responsibility. I don't know what exactly a better answer would have been, because it was tremendous resources to solve that problem once it sunk. And possibly, back to maybe Mr. Ewing's point, if we had a boat repair yard here, which would not only have the benefit of having an environmentally sound place to do, channel people are doing all the repairs, but also the benefit for emergency haul out or a haul out when something like that is needed, we could probably maybe look at forcing a haul out or something. But I mean, there was nothing to do with that vessel. And it probably, we can't cut it loose and force him to go in the ocean. The owner was in Texas. He kept saying he was going to come out and take care of it, or, you know, but he had apparently no resources, as we learned later. He had
and we did have a hoist, you know, a traveling hoist, and a haul-out facility. Would the city take the responsibility to pick that boat out and take it out without the owner's okay?
I think that that's something, you know, that is a more feasible approach. Obviously, your costs are going to be substantially less, probably, and your risks in taking that action are going to be substantially less, because you can haul it out and store it on the dry, and it's the daily costs. And we, you know, the daily costs, you're probably not going to damage a boat, in other words, which okay. is one of the big concerns. So that would be a solution that would be less risk. You may eventually get stuck with it, but it also is going to mean it's going to be probably a lot cheaper to demolish the boat eventually as it gets abandoned, you runs up fees and all that other stuff.
Yeah, but what my point or that I was trying to get out was, would we, I mean, you do take on a legal jeopardy when you do something like that.
The risk.
Could you do that and you know, be allowed to do that legally? Say, okay, it looks like it's in danger of sinking. I'm going to, on my own hook, decide that I want to take this boat and pick it up and put it on the hard.
Could you do that if that was part of the legal agreement from a rental agreement?
We could require that in our state law. My feeling is there are also, in our local laws, in our local rules and regulations and laws, we could give ourselves that power. Our impound ordinance actually has pretty substantial power for the city. Where that might conflict with state and federal law does concern me occasionally. Taking such aggressive action on a documented vessel, for example, without going through the federal lien sale process and acquiring legal title and right to do that, you would be at some risk. But there is help in Amelia, and there is also other laws that overlap, such as, you know, taking immediate steps to
pollution law.
Pollution. You can get them cited for a threat to pollute or notified of a threat to pollute and take emergency action. So it's complicated stuff, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's not like the vehicle code. I wish it was, you know, with cars and but I think that you know, and it always in this business with all the various laws and things like that, is a benefit-risk analysis. Your risk is substantially lower when you did have a, you know, a place to haul out and store.
There are two different items, two different venues.
I'm a little bit lost, but when, you know, develop what you're trying to do and let us know. My hope is that we can get some maybe consensus on what the board thinks we should work on, and that we would return with some with the harbor rules and regulations changes at your next meeting. So give me your feedback. I'm not sure I'm totally clear what you're suggesting right now, though.
Roger.
Is there a way that the city's contract for the services that you provide to the boats that visit and use the city facilities, is there a legal way that they could sign? Should I not be in compliance with, you know, should I not remain current up to 90 days or something? I give up my rights to, you know, any entitlements that a documented vessel has, and the city can take whatever action is necessary. I'm sure there's got to be a port or harbor somewhere that has dealt with this, and is there a regulation we could borrow that stands the test of law?
In the end, the bottom line, the answer to your question is we are preempted by state and certainly federal law. So no matter what law or local regulation we might pass, it is not going to trump the federal law. So we can, and we do. Our agreement that they sign says you will abide by our rules and regulations, you will pay your fee, or we can terminate this and kick you out. Or use our impound ordinance as another. But then again, when we actually get into the application on each case, that doesn't mean, even if they sign that thing, it doesn't mean that they might be able to use a federal law to assert
some other rights.
If they signed a contract, though, saying I give up my rights under federal law that I am entitled to, if there is doesn't sound like you're very confident that
it won't work for the city.
I'm not sure.
I think it's like people can't really sign their rights away to say to suing you. Like when you fill out those waivers, you can sign it, but it really doesn't absolve you, and they could still sue you, and it's a similar thing with that.
And you'd have to be careful because, first of all, you got to consider the options. Guy comes in here or is here with a boat that's sinking. You tell him the boat's risk for pollution, and it's can't put a person in a catch-22 and say you're going to do this, this, and this if there's no facilities to do it with. That's all.
Okay. And if I might clarify one thing, what I would like to suggest is that this operability or seaworthiness test, if they fail to meet the requirements of that, I'm not suggesting that we either beat them up or take their boat because there's so much cost and liability in that. What I'm suggesting, where we really do have some leverage in most cases, is our mooring agreement, especially our mooring agreement, or our slip agreement with our commercial slip holders, and a little less extent to any agreement on the daily basis at the piers. That's going to be the problem, because what do you do with a boat that says, well, I ain't going anywhere, but we can apply pressure there. But in the mooring situation, which is a good example to run through maybe, there's 70 city moorings on monthly agreements, and then there's another 50, 55 that are under a lease agreement with the city, operated by two private operators, but under lease the city. And I think we could work on those as though those were ours. And of those 120 boats or so that are on those moorings, there are some that are probably not operable. There are some that may not be seaworthy. And we would start with those, and those folks probably would comply because they would not want to lose their mooring agreement. And that's what would be at risk.
Yes, but there's very few fishing boats on those moorings.
That's true. Those tend to be more the recreational boats.
They're mostly plastic now.
Mm-hmm. But they still are a threat to pollute, I think.
That's true.
I think that's true in the sense that probably our biggest threats are the big commercial boats, say, that might be at the T pier. But we're looking at everything, or as much as we can. Now, I'm just talking, again, this would be our rules and regulations, and people who sign the agreement to conform with our rules and regulations in general apply to city facilities. That's the first paragraph, boats at city facilities. So there are, of course, a number of privately operated marinas, and that would include the State Park Marina, where this would not be something we would go in and say, your boat has to be operable, or because we couldn't kick them out, for one thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The way I see it right now, we are wandering around and around, and we really still have to take into consideration the proposed new harbor rules and regulations, and the board a chance to go look at these and see if there are any others that we would recommend changes to, additions, or deletions. Okay? Is that okay with the board? Okay. Then I guess at this point we move from the item 4-3 to item 4-4, and what I'd like to do is at this point go through the changes and your rationale, if that's okay with you, Rick.
Yeah. You want to try? Okay. Sue, we're going to give you a change of pace here. Sue's going to run through these.
Okay.
What we did was we went through and put in the changes. They are underlined, and there's little markings on the side that would show you where those were. So a lot of the changes are just kind of housekeeping and cleaning up things to bring the rules and regs to current.
Right.
So a lot of the things just refer to, for example, a lot of the places we took out specific dollar amounts and put as provided for in the master fee schedule, so things would stay consistent all the time.
Yeah. So why don't we just
we'll focus on the ones.
Yeah.
We'll
just ignore the housekeeping.
Okay.
And go with the biggies.
Okay.
Oh, excuse me, Jim.
Before we passed beyond Rule 1. It's got in capital letters there, rental agreement, and I would for one like to see a copy of the rental agreement, both for all of the things that you have rental agreements for. At some point, I don't need it today. But
well, let me ask a question then. Would you like copies in the next packet, or you want to come in and you want us to send individuals copy, or you want to come in the office and get maybe send?
How about the rest of you? Do you want a copy or need a copy, or maybe I'm the only one?
I think it'd be nice to see that the.
Why don't we just? It's easy enough. It's a short agreement. We'll just put it in the next packet.
Why don't we just put it in the packet?
Yeah, we could. There's basically two forms. There's a two-page form that's for slips and moorings. It's essentially the same for both of those, even though they're administered slightly differently because they're different facilities. And then for our transient users, we have a small 3x5, what we call a dockage card, that has all their information on the front and a brief listing of the rules and regs. Basically says you must abide by all our rules and regs and makes them sign it. So mm-hmm. We can put those on with the next one.
Yeah, I think that would be fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
No problem. So you're probably not interested in stuff changes to the commercial slip agreement, changes in potentially setting up a waiting list for city moorings. The reason we put that in was because there's such more demand now than there ever was in the past, so we were considering doing that. So basically what you're interested in is under Section 5, which talks about Harbor Department responsibility to protect safe and efficient operation of city facilities. And we always have had language in the rules that were operable and seaworthy. And that language is on the last paragraph in that section, and it's all underlined. And it talks about having the vessel inspected by a qualified independent marine surveyor as to the seaworthiness, and if that is not done, then the vessel owner would be given 120 days to make repairs and complete the test, and if after that time they could not successfully complete the required test, then the mooring or slip agreement shall be terminated and the vessel will be not denied further use of city facilities, may be subject to citation and impoundment. Again, in terms of preventing pollution, without a boatyard or a place to haul these out, even if we put it on our impound mooring, there's still a problem. So there is an issue. If a boat is over 35 or 40 feet, it's problematic in actually removing that threat from the water of it to pollute. That's just reality. So something we should all be aware of. That's probably the main section in here that talks about that. And I think if you'll see, you know, we talk about several things, emergency and holding the city harmless, and there are lots of sections that talk about the need to keep vessels safe and operable.
Mm-hmm.
And including on the last page, we changed regulations about work that is enabled to be done, and we used to have something saying that repairs and mechanical work would be limited to minor jobs which could be completed, and that was going to be in the launch ramp parking lot. We've removed that because we need to be much more stringent about the kind of boatyard work we allow to be done just on public property. So that has been removed entirely. People can no longer do that at all. They need to take their boats to a boatyard or have their work done in a clean and efficient manner.
Right, that's another. And I'm going to do another advertisement again, is for a moment. And you know, another thing I left out of the long list of things that we've done over the last 12 years is there was we've installed a number of sewage pump outs, and those are regularly used, and they take a lot of maintenance and work to keep those things running. And I think, short of having one at the State Park Marina, we're in pretty good shape. We seem to be meeting demand. There is a grant still, I think, out there potentially with the NEP to work on a floating pump out through the Department of Boating and Waterways in conjunction with the Coastal Commission. You can actually get a clean marina certification. To do that, you have to prove that you're meeting their best management practices. Chief Arbitral Officer Endersby is working on actually getting that certification, and we're hoping that this fall we will actually get that certification. So we are following many of the same rules, or we're trying to, we are now, and we're doing many of the things that many other marinas are doing. And as you describe in Newport, I mean, I don't care if it's Crescent City or a little, you know, Bay Area Delta Marina or Newport Bay or San Diego, everybody has these same problems.
Yeah.
And some have more resources to deal with them, but everybody's got the same problems. Thank you. I'm sorry, Jim, to interrupt you.
Go ahead, Jim.
I think that floating pump-out station will be a, I just think in my head anyway, it would be a real asset, particularly in the State Park Marina, since there isn't one there. And, you know, there is some difficulty with the tides getting some of those boats in and out at a time when you want to do it, for instance. And so to have a pump-out facility available to go back there to take care of those problems, I think, would be real helpful. We were on, I guess, Area 15 there. The part that you strike out regarding doing repair work and such near the launch ramp, was it intended to strike out parking time limits and parking regulations within the parking lot shall be designated and marked with appropriate colors and letters?
No, there was a duplication. If you look up about, that's the last paragraph.
Oh, I
see.
Three
paragraphs above that covers that. We realized it was kind of a duplication, so we just took it out.
I see that now. Thank you very much.
Okay. Start with you, Roger.
Yeah. On that back page under item 15, the second paragraph, I think the strikeout should begin with shall, not with work.
Yeah.
It's just a typo.
Yeah. So the thing would say repairs and mechanical work.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
Thank you. And then on, where did I even? On 2B, the second paragraph, where you talk about the commercial slips and anybody on the list for more than 5 years has to requalify.
A slip who's been on the list for several years does have to show us tickets for that year to get the slip. But what we've had an issue with is we've had boats that just stay on the list and stay on the list and stay on the list, and there's really no point. If they're not commercial anymore, if they're not active, that for one thing, they could get their deposit back. And, you know, the other thing, we, you know, tried to make sure that people give us appropriate phone numbers and addresses, which I would say there's at least 4 vessels on the list that we no longer have current addresses or phone numbers, and so they effectively are off the list. It is that person's responsibility to keep us informed. So again, in this case, if they're on the list for more than 5 years and they've moved and haven't notified us, we will send them that letter. But if that letter comes back, well, that's the way it is.
Okay. Gene?
Under 15, on the last paragraph, repairs and mechanical work be limited. That's the area that you struck out, dealing with a launch ramp. If somebody needs to put a new pin in their prop or something or other, does that mean they can't just pull back out in the parking lot and put a pin in the prop or do a little maintenance work on their boat or, you know, rig their boat up or fix the shroud or something or other? I mean, there's got to be some flexibility there, I think. Otherwise,
it's
too hard.
If it's
posted,
they probably still will anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm not too worried about that.
Just
to tell you the truth.
Isn't this to deal more with abusers?
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that if in case somebody is out there tearing his engine apart, then you say, no, you can't do that. But if somebody's putting a pin in there, you know, the... Okay. Eddie?
I just wondered, you know, we're here sitting up here making suggestions, but the people that should have the best suggestions should be the harbor department. They're the ones that have to deal with all this stuff. And I just wondered if there was any specific suggestions or changes that Rick wanted or the harbor department wanted. That's all.
I think, aren't these the ones?
Those are part of it. That's not, you know, there's, I'm sure he asked for other stuff, you know.
Oh, okay.
I believe earlier he asked for other stuff rather than just taking a look at these regulations. There may be some changes that he may have thought of since we were...
Most of the non-city facilities are still on lease sites, are they not?
Oh, yeah.
I can't think of any examples other than even the State Park Marina is under city jurisdiction now. When those leases are renewed, it would seem important that those that have boat facilities, that their lease have language that brings them, that they must have requirements of the boats at their facilities that meet the same standards as the city facilities. As a leaseholder, I know we're held responsible. You don't take on anything. It's all on us. and that's fine. That's
the way we like it.
Yeah, yeah. And send us the check. But I think that leaseholders would have an easier time getting rid of a problem vessel if the boat owner didn't see that private facility as a safe harbor. They could evict them, in other words, and send them down to the tee pier and let Rick deal with them there.
Yeah. That's what happens. Yeah.
But I really think that the same rules have to apply to the private facilities as the city, or we're going to end up with problems that the Harbor Patrol isn't even as aware of because they're not on city facilities, and the deterioration would be even... It would be discovered at a much later date.
Jim, did you have something?
I think he asked or referred to the same question I have. In regards to the yacht club's mooring area, which is leased from the city, do these rules about seaworthiness apply to those moorings as well as any rules that the yacht club might have?
I think we probably would have to write something into that lease to make it specific. I'd have to go back and review that lease. Unfortunately, I guess I didn't really think that one through totally, but I'm sure there's a way, because those are relatively short-term leases that we do for the mooring areas, we can coordinate them. And it would be my suggestion that we do in this case, that we require both those mooring blocks to have the same standards at least.
Thank you. Strictly from my own personal...
In general, all our leases say, as Roger may remember too, you have to follow all the rules and laws of the city.
Yeah.
So we have that authority in a broad sense. I think it's more specific in the mooring area leases even. But what we tried to do, the context of this rules and regs was really to try and set up our operating procedures and rules and regs for our facilities. So that's sort of the general definition. We do have ordinances for citywide requirements for facilities that give us certain rights and obligations in managing, vessels and things like that, too. And that's a whole other level, the municipal code with the ordinances. This is a resolution that's authorized by ordinances. Is a little more flexible, easier for us to change, and so it's a good tool for us to set our sort of operating procedures for city facilities. So that's sort of the context with these, though.
Okay. If there are no other comments or questions, then I think we'll just say, okay, we will each of us take this back, go back through it, see if there are any additions or any deletions or whatever comments, and then we will re-agendize this for October as you recommended, and at which point in time the objective will be to to come up with whatever we would like to recommend through to the city council as changes to the rules and regs.
Take one more note. Yeah, thank you. That's what I would appreciate if we could return and with further thoughts and comments on this at your next meeting. On Section 10, there was a change that may be significant to some, and I don't think we covered it. It's a little small area there where fish unloading and sales continues to be an area of controversy for us because, really, I think that we've always had controversy over whether fish buyers, outside fish buyers, fish buyers on lease sites with insurance and fixed costs here. The live fish business then really made things mobile, and we found a lot of fish buying going all over. And we've had these discussions here before. And the fish buying buyers, our rules and regs now allow owners of vessels at city slips to unload their own fish to a fish buyer if you take it off on hand and the buyer saves in a parking lot. In some cases, that's how small this industry is, live fish. I mean, it's not a big, they get high value for, you know, about 5,000 pounds a year allowed in a nearshore fishery. That's all a guy gets to catch, and so they get an $8 or $10 a pound. So they actually can hand haul this stuff. I mean, the boat launch ramp is not an area that's allowed for fish buyers to go down there and buy off, you know, transient boats or boats in that may be using the launch ramp.
Can I ask why that regulation? I mean, why don't we allow a fish buyer on the TPR? Is it liability insurance and things like that?
Yes, yeah, it's kind of all those things. And there is an element, to be honest, where we think, you know, if we have some established businesses who have the overhead and are providing live tanks and are, you know, providing a service in a stable buying environment, we shouldn't just allow, you know, any guy with a truck who's in business for a month to come in and undercut him. There is an element to that because it's not good for us in the long run. But it's also a concern for liability, operations in public facilities. You know, they probably don't have business license because they're, you know, they're a lot of other things. So we're trying to get some regulation on it and still allow enough flexibility for an individual who owns a vessel who's willing to hand haul it themselves possibly to operate.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, in conjunction with that, if you look right above that, we have temporary storage of crab or fish receivers may be allowed with prior written permission of the city. And that's, again, a similar change because of the small amounts of fish that are being offloaded and people wanting to keep them in receivers. So that was added as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, then we'll move on. Information items. Harbor Department status report. Who has the helm on this one?
I think Sue wants me to start with the MLPI thing, and then she'll do the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think most of you know, since our last meeting, the Fish and Game Commission met on August 15th in Monterey. They ended up having a long, long meeting, and about, I think, 9 o'clock at night, they recommended a preferred alternative that was more restrictive than even the Package P that was proposed by the Fish and Game Department staff. In the end, they ended up going close to what was called Package 3R. Or you're really using Package 3R, which was recommended by the Blue Ribbon Task Force as their base. Very disappointing. I think I'll get myself in trouble here. I think a bad decision, frankly, because they're ending up bad for the environment, along with local businesses, because they're ending up proposing closures for probably 50% of the good fishing areas in our area. And it will force the existing fishermen in the near February and March of next year. And so there's the environmental analysis happens on their preferred alternative and the other alternatives. And I think they're looking at mid-year next year to set up an implementation program on how to actually enact the law and how they will pay for enforcement.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Coming up in September the 17th to the 20th in Long Beach is the California and World Ocean Conference. And the City of Morro Bay will actually have a panel that will be held at 10:15 on the 19th entitled Commercial Fishing in California's Fishing Heritage Harbor, Current Issues, and Do They Have a Future in California? Also, Dr. Dean Wendt will be heading a panel discussion on ecosystems-based management from 4:15 to 6 p.m., so the Central Coast will have a bit of a presence. This is a pretty big conference. It's going to be covering a lot of different areas, and if you're interested in finding details on it and all the other presentations that are scheduled, you can go online. There's a very, very, very long address here, but if you just Google it and look for California World Ocean Conference, you will find it. That's probably the easiest way to get it if you don't have this written down. Harbor Festival is right around the corner, and I'll mention this again at our October meeting, but I like to remind people that This is actually the 25th Harbor Festival. I'd like to remind people that during the festival, access down to our area, the waterfront north of Beach Street, is very limited. So we always ask people to park uptown and use the trolley. People who do have boats there will be allowed to get in. We just request you walk in, not drive in, because it's difficult. And as usual, there will be an Old Town After Dark in conjunction with the festival. It's going to be the weekend of October 7th through 8th. There's going to be a Bay Cruiser Show and Shine competition that evening. And then during the day, there will be the Maritime Pavilion, Coast Guard Harbor Patrol Open House, Morro Bay Fire Department Fire Safety Education Trailer, and the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization will be having their wonderful albacore and more barbecue. So it'll probably be a fun event. Just remember, it's a little tougher to get around down the Embarcadero at that time. And again, anybody who has parked a vehicle north of our office with those parking passes will need to move it prior to the festival, probably by October 4th. Things we were talking about tonight, how every port deals with all these problems and issues that come up. Council action on August 28th, Council approved assignment of lease site 8686W from the Fishbowl LLC to Burton Caldwell. And the Fishbowl actually is no longer there, which is kind of strange because it's been here for so long. So they shut their doors down. We're not sure what'll go in. We'll see what happens. 9192, the Council approved execution of a deed of trust. A couple different things. Now, this I put in for people so they'd be aware ahead of time. The Earth Rapes boat did come here on September 2nd. I don't know if people saw it. It was quite the thing. It really looked like a spaceship more than a boat. It's a showcase for a biodiesel boat that actually is the anti-fouling instead of paint. They use a non-toxic wax on it. So they're trying to be a showcase for an environmentally propelled and cared for vessel. And they're going to attempt to break a world record of going around circumnavigating the globe. So I do think a lot of people came down to take a look at it. Again, this was something that happened last weekend. There was the Watershed Conference put on by Surf Rowdy Foundation, Sierra Clubs, Low Coast Alliance, EcoSlow, Morro Bay NEP, Ocean Outfall Group. They had a talk about the bay at the Vets Hall. And they talked about a lot of things, including overall land use, the sea otter situations in Los Osos with the wastewater situation, and future of coastal power plants. And also something that's coming up in October is the annual State of the Bay Conference that the NEP puts on, and that's going to be October 13th through 14th. And if you want information on that, you can contact the NEP, 772-3834. And that's about it.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions?
Yes. On October 8th, we will once again have our 25th annual longboard paddle out at Coleman Beach during the Harbor Festival on Sunday at noon. So bring your board and paddle out.
You have to be at least 90 years old to do this, don't you? Anyone else? Okay, then we're going to move on to additional comments. Any comments? Oh, yeah, that was your comment, right? Okay. Now we're in the agenda items. Okay. Obviously, rules and regulations. If the Fish and Game, Dean Heilman or somebody wanted to come over and sort of give a thing that we could, you know, put it out here and get a, you know, what's going to happen, what is happening, what will happen.
I don't think they know yet.
I know they don't, but somebody might have a little more of a handle on it in October. Anyhow, if we can do it, fine. If we can't, okay.
Well, how about, I mean, I can provide you the two pages of color maps. If we can get the color of the Fish and Game Commission's preferred alternative at this point, it's the most likely. There's a lot still to be said and done, but yeah, that will show you that. And the Bouchon is mostly, it's commercial and recreational closures. And
yeah,
it's basically a good part of Bouchon. And then just north of, just at the north of the Point Estero, there'll be commercial Well, anyway, I'll bring in the maps.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Any additional agenda items?
I got one. I'd like to discuss conceptual plans for a boatyard in the next meeting and see what we could do. That needs to be taken care of, I believe, and Rick may have some more time by then, and we can toss it around and for size and location. Well, I got there was only one location for it anyway, so it's just a matter of how big and how much and who does what when. So that's what I'd like to have on the agenda.
Okay.
That board consensus that we, and we can do that. I won't probably provide you a whole lot more other than we did do some money, and I haven't. And the reason I really haven't started on that project yet is with the State Park Marina, which is a big project taking a lot of time. And until this, I get this ice machine thing done, I just haven't had time to focus on it. But, you know, we'll have to, we would hire a consultant to start working on a concept plan for us, start fleshing out, working with the public and us on trying to show how it might work out at some location there.
Okay. Without any additional agenda items, we get down to the last item.
I move we adjourn.
Ah, I was waiting for that.
You seconded it. You did.
I'll second it, and I'll say it's adjourned.